Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. wandaspicks.asmnetwork.org. Tune in Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time. This is a Black arts and culture site. We will be exploring the African diaspora via the writing, performance, both musical and theatrical, film and stage, as well as the visual arts of Africans in the diaspora and those influenced by these aesthetic forms of expression. I'm interested in the political and social ramifications of art on society, specifically movements supported by these artists and their forebears. It is my claim that the artists are the true revolutionaries, their work honest and filled with raw, unedited passion. They are true heroes. Ashe. So remember, visit us on Wednesdays 6 to 7 a.m. and Fridays 8 to 10 a.m. Pacific Time on wandaspicks.asmnnetwork.org. Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks. We are joined today by Anne L. Chin, who is the executive director of the Middle Passage Ceremonies and Port Markers Project. And Middle Passage Ceremonies and Port Markers Project is a self-described community. She is a self-described community activist, she writes. And her work has included children and family advocacy with Washington, D.C. government and work as a retailer, textile artist, and organizer of a collective artist market. She has also written an extensive family history in collaboration with family members. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Wanda.
Good morning. I'm so excited about this first commemoration of one of the ports that our ancestors came into, and we were talking off the air about how there are 174 identified such ports, and over the next, I believe you said, 8 years?
Yes, 8 years.
Yeah, the goal is to commemorate our ancestors in each one of these ports. And it's like, wow, that is so marvelous.
Well, I think, you know, basically we are addressing the Black Atlantic. And the fact that over the course of 350 years, millions of Africans died just in the crossing, and their lives are basically, for most of us, I think for almost all of us, unknown, and for many of us, completely forgotten. So this project will address ancestors who died in the voyage, as well as to celebrate those who survived, who arrived and survived.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, and tomorrow, August 23rd, is specifically chosen because it's one of the, I believe, 3 days that UNESCO identified with regards to the Black Holocaust or the Mahatma.
Yeah, that's true. August 23rd was the day of remembering the trade as well as its abolition. I like that combination. and also the fact that August is a particularly poignant month because it was during the months of July, August, and September, during the trade, that the ships, the companies that brought our ancestors here, delivered them. The winds are strongest going across the Atlantic at that period of time, so it made the journey easier. And, of course, we're talking a system that's based on commerce, so it was also more profitable to move your cargo, that's our ancestors, across that huge body of water. And so to have it in August as opposed to, for us, March or December is more meaningful. But as I have said many times, any day, any time will do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, any day, any time, every day we should.
Exactly.
Yeah, but these big community commemorations are just so wonderful, and they just pull together so much energy.
Oh, it's been, you know, it's been heartening for me, and all of us who are working on it, the response of the residents and groups in Baltimore and the area, but also across the nation, across the world. I mean, people are coming. You know, the one in Baltimore is exciting for us because it's our first.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people who say, oh, I can't make it. I said, it's okay. We got 174 more to go. You know, because there are actually 175. Some cities already do their commemoration. I think you've spoken with some mm-hmm. groups.
Right.
In Hampton and Charleston.
Right,
these are in the
Texas.
U.S. Right, right. So those cities, we will simply, just as, you know, other organizations have networked, we want to do the same thing. And as we go to these port cities to arrange for the ceremonies and hopefully eventually a physical marker in each one of those areas or spots, we will plug them in to other groups, you know, that are already in existence and operating. So eventually, I mean, my vision is that we'll all hold hands around this ocean, you know, in honor
wow.
of our ancestors.
Yeah. Wow. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about the team and, like, who are you all? You're the executive director, but who's the team? And you've been working on this for you know, quite some years. I mean, you've been doing this for a long, long time. It's like you believe you say in your biography that, you know, you feel called to this. And you write that you were born and raised with a loving, diverse family whose history in this land, more than 300 years of Tidewater Virginians, New England Patriots, and the District of Columbia and Georgetown residents. You say that you attended public and parochial schools, Mount Holyoke College, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and the George Washington University. And in this life, you say your treasures are 3 children and 3 grandchildren, a daughter by marriage and 3 grandchildren, a patient spouse, numerous relatives, wonderful friends, and 4 acres of land on St. Helena Island in South Carolina. So how... Tell us about, you know, sort of your passion for this, but tell us about the team first, you know, that you're working with to pull this together and, you know, start this, you know, this massive journey.
Well, we have for honorary boards, we have people just such as Dr. Vincent Harding.
Nice.
And then
maybe you could tell us a little bit about your board, like, so Dr. Vincent Harding.
Sure, mm-hmm. sure. Dr. Vincent Harding, Randall Robinson, Charlene Hunter Gault are examples of who's on the honorary board. The advisory board are the people who we depend upon for direction. That includes Dr. Bernice Johnson Regan. Sweet Honey in the Rock. I guess that's probably how a lot of people know her.
Yeah.
But she's a musicologist.
And her work in, you know, the civil rights movement.
Exactly. One of the freedom singers, one of the SNCC freedom singers, original.
Mm-hmm.
We have also Dr. David Eltis, whose work we used, his research of the past 10 years with another Dr. David Richardson, produced the database for the voyages of the slave trade. And in fact, he sent me a memo last night saying, "Ann, where did you get this figure 2 to 6 million? I can only find 2 million Africans on the trade." And I went, "Okay, we'll correct it." You know, so we're now just saying over 1 million Africans died during the Atlantic voyage.
Mm-hmm.
But people like that who you know, keep our feet to the fire, make sure that we are presenting the information correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, research expands and data is more accurate, we will change the information. Because I think that our history is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to know it and then act upon it. You know, it's nice for people to do the research. It's nice to have the data. What do you do with that?
Right.
And I think that this project addresses that part we are doing ceremonies for our ancestors. Now we know where they arrived. We know approximately how many souls we are addressing, you know, over a million. And what do we do, again, about this in terms of our personal lives? How do we conduct ourselves? I think that after a ceremony, after this acknowledgement, it will help us retain our own humanity. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the points of it. We also have Dr. Joanne Braxton of the Middle Passage Project, William and Mary, who helped us with the design of the ceremony itself. We also have people who are not board members, but you know, certainly have been active, and they would include Estella Conwell Majozo, who we spoke to also, and she was heavily involved with her family in terms of the African burial ground, just giving us advice on again what the ceremony ought to look like. Dr. Rachel Harding, who does cultural anthropology, she also was involved. We have people like Shadra Pittman Walker, who I think that you've already interviewed, of the Sankofa Project in Hampton. You know, the team is huge, and then there are local people here in Baltimore who, you know, I've gotten a terrible reputation on one level in Baltimore. They said, you know, you ask for everything. You know, I'm going, I don't have funds. I'm not independently wealthy. Mm-hmm. And even if I were, it would still need support, you know, of the residents and organizations within the city. And they have been, I mean, just amazingly generous, you know, from the three African-American museums to churches.
What three African-American museums?
There's the Reginald Lewis Museum, the Great Blacks in Wax, and the Douglas Myers Museum are all three, and they have supported us and put out the word within their network. So it's like I said, it's been a positive. And this is our, you know, I jokingly say our dry run, you know, it's our first one. So, you know, there are things that we couldn't do perfectly, and I accept that. And I think I will say probably at every port after we have organized the first ceremony, you know, the thing that I want you to do is to, number one, establish this as an event, a regular event within the locales, but also to tell the communities, you know, you can look at this first one and go, we could do better than that. You know, I really want people to take ownership of this and to begin the healing process. I mean, shame should not be what we view our history. I mean, we should look at it as continual struggle and resistance against what was placed upon us.
Right, right. Yeah, you were talking about the design of the ceremony, and I was thinking as you were speaking about the museum that's opening soon, maybe I don't know if it's a year or two, but they broke ground this year, the African Diaspora Museum at the Smithsonian. You know, that broke ground earlier this year, I believe it was in February, and we had one of the curatorial team on the air, and I was wondering, since you're so close to Washington, D.C., I'm thinking, like, wow, you have, like, a real creme de la creme on your advisory and on your, I mean, I was like, oh, I heard of that person. I was like, not really that person? I was like, oh, yeah, so tell me about the networking. How did you get these folks as your advisory team? Is it just because you've been doing the work for so long, or what? And then I want you to tell us about the design of the ceremony. And so are you going to be taking, like, next year you'll be at another port? And how that's happening over the next 8 years? How do you plan on marking these ports?
Okay, well, I'll start with the networking. I'm 65 years old, and I've been active in the community for at least 40 of those years, if not more. Actually more, I won't tell you. but over that period of time and with family members and the history of activism, you know, a lot of the people who agreed to participate and come on board are part of that history, you know, and my family will tell you I have them, you know, working overtime with the project. But people like, I will say, for example, Dr. Bernice Johnson Regan, I mean, I've seen her at events. We have in our family history, an association with SNCC. But Dr. Regan and I had never, ever had a personal exchange. And I sent her the package asking her to become a member of one of the boards. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, she called me and she says, I don't remember. Would you send me a picture so I can see who you are? But what you want to do is so important that without hesitation, yes. And I think that that has been the response across the board. I've had very few people who have said, ah, can't do it, you know. So the project itself, you know, much more than any affiliation or personal connection with me, has motivated people to join and support in whichever way they've been asked to do so.
Yeah, but tell us about, you know, Dr. Vincent Harding and Charlene Hunter-Goff, who's in South Africa.
Well, she's here now. She's moved.
Oh, she's
moved
back.
She's moved back. And
I remember watching her on the news. I'm
that's
like,
right.
Oh.
That's right. So, you know, she's back in the States, and we're to meet in the fall to go over the coming year, what's planned, and, of course, how to raise funds. Because all this requires some travel. The ceremony itself, I think, we wanted to make sure that it was inclusive. And so we've developed or designed a template that we will offer to each port city mm-hmm. for them to consider. And then the elements will be the libation, the calling of names, a prayer, and the drumming. Those are the four elements. Now, what else is designed in each locale is up to the descendant community. We're not heavy-handed. We simply want to say make sure it happens, that the ancestors are honored. Mm-hmm. And so some areas will have dancing, some will have, you know, extensive community representation, you know, eventually, or if we can have enough time within the ceremonies or within the program. Like on the 29th of September in Annapolis, we are folding into the Kunta Kinte Festival so that we will be part of the morning at the waterfront doing the libation. They will have the drumming, we'll say the prayer, and simply ask people to call out the names of ancestors. So in each port, I mean, the ceremony may look different, but there will be some basic elements that we're hoping each locale will respect.
Okay.
This coming year, after we finish Maryland, which we hope we will finish by the end of October, so we will have in Maryland, Baltimore, Annapolis, and the Sutterly Plantation, which is in St. Mary's County. And they were a middle passage port on the Patuxent River. The Royal African Company brought people from Ghana to that port. So we're going to arrange, hopefully, to have an Akan priest to do the remembrance ceremony there. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to trace people's heritage also in terms of the ports and the ceremonies. You know, some places will have a heavier representation from Angola. Some will have a heavier representation from Senegambia. Mm-hmm. So it ranges, and we'll try to respect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, my family's from Mississippi, and I was born in New Orleans. So where are the ports in that area?
The ports in Mississippi, one port in Mississippi, which is Biloxi.
Oh,
And then in New Orleans, in Louisiana, actually, there are two. It's New Orleans, of course, is the primary one, mm-hmm. but we also have La Belize, mm-hmm. I think it's called. La Belize, which was actually the port that the pirate Lafitte.
Oh yeah.
that he controlled. I mean, what you end up with these ports is a lot of the local history.
Yeah. You know?
And then for Mississippi, you also have Africans who came in through Mobile.
Okay.
And
right.
And depending upon the history, they may have also come from Pensacola, because that was also a port. So, you know, if it's Pensacola, for the most part, the Africans originally arrived in Cuba, mm-hmm. and then were transported to Pensacola, mm-hmm. to be fed into whatever the plantation systems were. But so you have Pensacola, Mobile, New Orleans, La Belize, and then you have to look at Texas. And Texas has Galveston and ports all along the Sabine River, because folks were smuggled even after there was an abolition of the importation mm-hmm. of Africans. They were smuggled in, and they mostly came through Texas, because that was still Mexican territory.
Interesting. Yeah, but even after the official importation of Africans was halted legally, Africans were still coming in on the East Coast too.
Oh yeah, I mean Key West is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, the Civil War had basically started, and they were, you know, I think the last group of Africans to be brought into the United States came in through Key West, and they were mostly children.
Oh, really?
And
what
more than 50
died.
More than 50% died. Yeah, it's a burial ground, and that's where in Key West that they have the annual
mm-hmm.
Remembrance ceremony, and in fact,
Sunday is going to be the one that's honoring the August 23rd.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean it's all connected. I mean we have such a wide range of people and histories, but it's all based on this oppression, this forced system. I mean the gentleman actually who is in Miami mm-hmm. coined a phrase that I truly love. And the other element that we're having is an inclusion of Native Americans
mm-hmm.
who will do the sage burning to clear the area so that we can hold our ceremony. So there's this expression that I picked up about 2 weeks ago called the first and the forest,
mm-hmm.
which I really love.
First and the forest?
The forest, that the first people
mm-hmm.
are going to join with those of us who are descendants of the forest, F-O-R-C-E-D. To hold the remembrance. And in Baltimore.
Oh, the forest.
The forest, yeah.
I thought you were saying forest.
No,
forest.
Yeah, that's why I spelled it, because I figured.
Yeah, thank you.
I did too when I first heard it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how are we the forest? You know, but it's the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And in Baltimore, when I approached the Baltimore American Indian Center to ask them if they would do the clearing for us,
mm-hmm.
They said, do what? And I went, we would like, you know, since this was your original land, we would like for you to clear it before we can hold our ceremony. And they just have been responding to me going, no one has ever asked us to do this before. I mean, no one has acknowledged us as people who should grant any sort of permission for the land, and I think it's important.
Yeah.
And I will say that, you know, the issue was first raised, you know, are you going to include Native Americans? And even I was like, I don't know. You know, and that came out of the Sankofa Project in Hampton. And, you know, Shadra Pittman-Walk said that, you know, you ought to consider that. And the more I thought about it, she's absolutely correct. And so that's what we did. I mean, and that's what I'm saying. People have, you know, volunteered information, suggested freely. It's been very encouraging to me. I mean, this project sat with me for 26 years. It was given to me on my 39th birthday.
Oh,
and I had and I had no idea what to do with it. It was inspired by Toni Morrison's concern that we had walked away, basically, and forgotten our ancestors who died in the Middle Passage. And, you know, she writes, something has to be done, a fixing ceremony. And that's what I see this as, a fixing ceremony that we can, you know, we can provide, we can perform. And I had went to church Sunday, and the host church here for the remembrance ceremony in Baltimore, the minister, Reverend Cecil Gray, who is actually the son of Victoria Gray, who was an icon in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and the movement there. Her son is now head of a church here, and they have opened charter schools, he and his wife and their community. And he said on the pulpit, he says, imagine if your mother or your father, your grandfather, your daughter or your cousin or your best friend died and you didn't do anything. You know, you just left, you didn't even, just, you know, you weren't concerned about where they were buried and you said nothing as if they didn't live. He says, that's what we've done to our ancestors, unless we take up this mantle.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking as you were speaking about how we here in the San Francisco Bay Area, our commemoration, the Ma'afa ritual, it's the day before Indigenous Peoples Day, and people say, oh, is it the first Sunday? It's like, no, it's sometimes it's not. It's the second Sunday sometimes. What you do is you figure out when Indigenous Peoples Day is, because we don't call it Columbus Day. We call it Indigenous Peoples Day, and it's the Sunday right before that, and that's the day we chose that day to honor, you know, our connection to the Indigenous people. And also, you know, our communities are linked because a lot of times our ancestors found refuge in the Indigenous communities, and so a lot of our people are both African and Indigenous because of that alliance.
That's true.
So, yeah, but I like the idea of the first in the forest. I totally have to bring that up to my folks.
Yeah.
Because that would work because, you know, I look at it being a ceremony for people of African descent, but it's on this land. And definitely the Indigenous people, you know, here in this land, but some people say that, you know, African people, particularly in California, were here as well. But definitely we're linked both geographically and through our bloodlines because of this forced, you know, immigration and forced labor.
That's awesome. And I want to raise a couple of other historical points.
Yes, please.
One is that until the 1820s, 77% of the people who came to the New World were Africans. Mm-hmm. That's a huge number. Mm-hmm. And it was all over the Western Hemisphere, from Canada straight down to almost the tip of South America. With every one of the conquistadors or explorers or whatever you want to call them, whether they came from Europe, you know, within those exploration groups, there was always at least one person of African descent. There's not a single European, Pizarro, Cortez, Ponce de Leon, Cartier, you name them, Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
All of them had Africans.
Right.
With
yeah.
them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we, you know, it's the same.
And we've been
as,
here a long time, yeah.
We've been here a long time. We've been mixing a long time. And we were even here, you know, if you read Van Sertima, before Columbus.
Yeah, we came before Columbus. Yeah.
Right.
And I think Van Sertima as well as others say that the reason why Africans were part of all of those voyages and explorations is because we were the navigators.
Right. We've been here
yeah.
before.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Yeah, the Europeans didn't know how to get there. They got lost.
Exactly.
Have an African at the helm, you know, reading the stars and charting the route. Mhm.
Yeah, so
yeah.
You know, our presence didn't start in what's documented as 1492.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't just, you know, be at particular points.
Mm-hmm.
We are up and down this Western Hemisphere. In some places we have mixed so heavily, especially in Central America,
mm-hmm.
that there's no distinction. Between what you look like and what your heritage is, we are basically a part of this hemisphere. When you talk about Cuban music or when you talk about Brazilian food or whatever, I mean, you have to fold in the influence of Africans and their descendants. There's no way to look at any nation, particularly in the Western Hemisphere, and not understand that its very essence in many ways incorporates African qualities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we've not been taught that. We just, you know, it's not acknowledged. But I think that beginning, as I said, 175 ports folks came to, and there's not a single nation on the east coast of either South America or Central America or the U.S. There's not a major port that does not have that as part of its history.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Well, we are out of time, and I wanted to ask you, in closing, if we can have you on again, you know, perhaps to talk about how the ceremony goes tomorrow. So exciting.
Oh, sure.
And what time is it going to happen?
Okay, in
and
Baltimore.
And give us the specifics for those that are in. Yeah, okay.
I will. In Baltimore at 6 a.m.
Okay.
And 7:15. We're asking people wish to that they wear white in honor of the ancestors, since it's really a memorial or remembrance ceremony. It will be at Broadway Pier, which is at Broadway and South Ann Streets in Fells Point. We understand that that might not be the exact historically correct location
mm-hmm.
in terms of Africans' arrival, but it is a pier, and it is in the harbor. And we will do further research actually is being done if the city decides that it wants a marker in terms of the correct placement. But it's open to the, as I said, to the public. Anybody can come and join with us in that ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be about the morning ceremony, the dawn, which is really special for me, will include the sage burning, a short historical narrative, a prayer, drumming, the libation, and the calling for the ancestors. The 7:15 program is a little bit longer. We expect more people.
You mean 7:15 in the evening?
In the evening.
Oh, so you're doing two more.
So dawn
okay.
and dusk. Yeah.
Okay.
So the 7:15.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the 7:15 at that particular ceremony, Dr. Bernice Johnson Regan will be singing.
Oh.
I remember, I believe.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah, yeah. And
will there be any, like, simulcasts or anything?
Well, no. What we do have, Morgan State University has been partnering with us on this project,
mm-hmm.
and they are actually going to do a video,
okay,
which eventually will be up on the website, on the MiddlePassageProject.org website,
mm-hmm.
As well as on Morgan's website in terms of their community outreach. So a doctoral student in videography will be spearheading that.
So it's kind of good.
So, yeah, so we're going to document. We're going to document this.
Excellent,
you
excellent.
Know,
yeah, and you said you send us images and you know links and things like that because we have your website on our website and your press release with the visual of Baltimore. The city that you have, and that's on the Maafa SFBayArea.com website, so people can go there as well and click on it. It's right there on the opening page.
Okay, well, I can't wait to tell you, you know, how I felt about this.
So maybe next Wednesday, next Wednesday we're commemorating Katrina, but maybe the Wednesday after. So we'll certainly have you on in the next week or two to talk about the first one and so are you going to, when is, which you mentioned like the reports in the Baltimore area, so is it every week you're going to do another one? How does that work?
No. In fact, in Baltimore it is tomorrow, August 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is September 29th in Annapolis at the Kunta Kinte Festival.
Okay.
And the third one, we have to work out the details, but we're hoping that by the end of October, and we'll put it up on our website, but by the end of October, at the Soderly Plantation. I don't even know where it is. I have to get directions. St. Mary's County, but that is the Middle Passage port for the Patuxent area.
Yeah.
And then we go on to hopefully doing two sites in Virginia
mm-hmm.
and the four in Florida. And the four in Florida will be Amelia Island, St. Augustine, Key West, which already is up and running in terms of holding their ceremonies, mm-hmm. and Pensacola.
Yeah, that's okay.
So that's what's planned, and
cool.
I think it can be pulled off. I'm really excited.
Yeah, and you're gonna this organization, you're going to be going to all of these ports.
Yeah,
bringing in the community, but you're gonna actually be the if there's not something happening. You all are going to make it happen.
Well, we're going to try our best.
The community.
You know, it's really up to the community. They say, no, we don't want to do this and we're not interested.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I think that we'll just do a personal
libation
and prayer.
Right.
You know, but we're going to make sure that the ancestors are honored. I mean, I have to keep my own personal vow that I've made
mm-hmm.
that they will be remembered. At least at each one of the nations. I mean, I might not be able to get to all the ports,
mm-hmm.
you know, myself personally.
Okay.
But we certainly will make sure that every single nation in which Africans arrived enslaved, that we're going to honor our ancestors.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know how they do, they had that really wonderful American team at the Olympics for the relay, those
mm-hmm.
beautiful black women.
Yeah.
So, hey, I'm right there with my head out.
wonderful.
Oh, this is so excellent. And, you know, such so fitting as well, you know, that it's during, you know, a time that we call Black August for all of the wonderful, you know, heroes we had and all of the insurrections, you know, like in Haiti and, you know, our sister Harriet Tubman was born this month and just all this great energy. And also we mourn a lot of people this month as well. So it's a great, great month to have this commemoration of our ancestors, you know, in Baltimore and the other place, actually in Baltimore and in Florida, because they're going to be doing the commemoration in Key West on Sunday. So that's going to be really, it's really awesome.
Right. And I just love to see us doing actions that confirm, as I said, our humanity, our value.
Yeah.
You know, when people talk about family values, this to me is what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
certainly.
You know, defining who we are
mm-hmm.
and acting upon that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's so important. And I also hope that this will trigger for people their own personal family histories. I mean, if you have some sense of, like you said, my people are from Mississippi, you know, where could they possibly have come in?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to be able to say, you know, well, these are some options. But then, of course, if you read the narratives that were written during the Federal Works Project during the Depression, a lot of people, their families originally came from Virginia,
mm-hmm.
which is why the Chesapeake region is so important as a first area for us to address, because folks arrived in this region, but they were transported south. They were marched, a lot of folks, marched south,
mm-hmm.
you know, as the frontier was cleared, and people started taking over, again, Native American territory.
Yeah.
So, you know, where we're from, I think eventually we're just going to have to say, you know, do the DNA. There's got to be an inexpensive way for us to swab ourselves and to find out, you know. I think that's a possibility. But but we can begin, and we can at least say, if we don't know exactly, we can go to this place. You know, if you're visiting or traveling or you live there,
mm-hmm.
and just say a prayer.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned, you know, the travels and the migrations and so, you know, one thinks about, you know, the Trail of Tears, you know, for our indigenous community, but, you know, there's the Trail of Tears for a lot of us. And that
right.
certainly was a trail of tears as people were shackled and moved, you know, these long distances, and dying, you know, or getting sick and being left to die, you
exactly.
know, as everyone else had to keep on moving.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm really happy you're doing this work. Oh, it's just, oh, my goodness, congratulations on the first one that's getting ready to happen. And, yeah.
I'm really
Mr. Ancestors just like,
oh, let me tell you, I always joke when I come against an obstacle in terms of putting this in place on any level,
mm-hmm.
you know, I do all I can, and then I go, okay, let's see what happens. And almost within, I would say, 24 to 48 hours,
mm-hmm.
it's cleared. It's fine. It's taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, things that I thought were insurmountable. So I say that the ancestors are really impatient with us. I mean, they want this done. You know what they're saying?
Yeah.
Don't, there's no excuses. You know, you will just do it. And
right.
and that's my sense. I tell folks I'm just pushed by the ancestors. I mean, they're behind me and they're just saying, get it done.
Yeah, because, you know, Dr. John Hendry Clark told us that, you know, we have to establish institutions, you know, to remember our ancestors. And you know, before the institution, we have to have a ritual. And so, you know, going to all these ports, because I actually, what I had seen us doing, and he mentioned, and I wanted to do that, you know, what he mentioned, is that having a monument at each one of these ports. So if we bring up the energy in each one of these spaces and it becomes a place of, you know, where people are doing the work around, you know, ancestor remembrance and repairing, you know, the damage that happened because of this, you know, sort of rift and of us from our homeland, you know, the continent that's
right.
known as Africa now, and the rift that continues in our communities. But this is a way to repair that, because if there are 174, 175 ports, then that means around the world, then it means, you know, this particular intentional you know, act will be one that sort of is something that we can all connect to and claim and repair our community in a way that is much better than giving us money.
but
money too. But
but not you know, huge amounts. Not, I mean, really not. I mean, I like I said, you could you know, take a cigar, you know,
yeah. mm-hmm.
Take a bottle of water.
Mm-hmm.
And do it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not, it's just such a simple act, but such a fulfilling one.
Yeah, it's not hard at all.
Not hard. And any community can do it. People can do it at home. Mm-hmm. You know, I say when something happens and you need some strength, your ancestors are there to give that to you. I mean, I remember reading this book where, you know, a scholar had said, we always talk about how we don't know our ancestors. We on this side of the Atlantic, that, you know, our ancestors are lost to us. Well, if you understand the tradition of the role of African communities, the role of ancestors, not only have we lost the ancestors, ancestors have lost us.
Mm-hmm.
They have a role to play, and they're not allowed to do that. I mean, because we have not connected with them.
Right.
So it is a full circle, and you know, this is, as I said, part of the healing, the repairing of that circle, mm-hmm. so that, you know, advice and guidance, you know, can be available, an opportunity.
Right.
To have that, and we don't have it now, mm-hmm. for the most part, as a general community. And people say, why are we doing so bad? Well, this is part of it. We don't know who we are. We don't connect with our past. We don't connect with our ancestors. We sort of live in the moment, mm-hmm. you know, or in the future, you know, planning for the future. But again, not connected to the past, except, you know, by definition of slavery, and that's not valid. That's mm-hmm. not valid for who we are.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, we are so much more.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
we certainly are.
Yeah. And I want to give a shout out to, you know, to Dr. Vincent Harding, because he was the speechwriter for Martin King, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, and I told him, I said, end of 8 years, you know, 2 ceremonies in Africa, and I'll be finished. And he went, you know, it was almost like, not on your life. you're not finished. This is huge. I just want people to understand that we're not creating. I mean, Dr. John Henry Clark was correct. I mean, there are institutions that need to be formed once we have done what Morrison calls the fixing ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
This project is not an institution. This project has one mission, and that is to hold the ceremonies mm-hmm. and to place, with cooperation and support of descendant communities, a marker at each one of those port sites. When that's done,
mm-hmm.
we're finished.
Mm-hmm.
On that part.
Yeah, on that project, yeah.
On that part, yeah.
And
yeah.
It's going to be over a period of 8 years, right?
We hope 8 years. We're hoping that by 2020, which would be the year after the arrival of the first Africans in Virginia,
mm-hmm.
Into the British colony part of the U.S. But, I mean, Africans were first brought to the Western Hemisphere as enslaved people in 1510. So that would be 510 years.
510 years later. Uh-huh.
Yeah, 510 years later. We're hoping that we can acknowledge all the ancestors who died in the Middle Passage.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, I first came across Dr. Vincent Harding's name in Joanne Griffin's book, Redefining Black Power, Reflections on the State of Black America.
Mm-hmm.
And that conversation that she transcribes in her book is like, oh, my God, it's so cool. He sounds like such a cool guy.
Oh, he is. He is. And, you know, when he first became a member of the honorary board, you know, he says, Ann, you know, I'm ready to roll.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Ann, for joining us, you know, the day before this historic event. And
thank you.
Yeah, give our audience the website one more time.
Okay, the website is www.middlepassageproject.org, and if you need to email me, middlepassagemarkers, that's plural on the markers, at gmail.com.
Okay, super. Well, congratulations, and have a great ceremony. We'll be pouring with you either physically or in our hearts at 6 a.m. Eastern Time, and at 7:15 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be singing with Sister Bernice.
All right. Okay. All right. Thank you, and look forward to talking with you again.
Oh, yeah, that'd be super. Yeah, let us know how it works out. That'd be excellent.
Okay. Thank you.
Peace and blessings. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Good morning, Kamala. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for hanging in there for 20 minutes.
Oh, no problem. It was fascinating and really excited for what's happening over there. Beautiful ceremonies coming up, and I hope to have an opportunity to participate in some way. So it was one lovely to hear about.
Yeah, and I'm so excited about the Dharmathon. How do you pronounce your last name, Kamala?
Damari.
Oh, how pretty. Hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've been getting all these emails from people that want me to pledge. and the Sacred Circle happens, you know, was the last one happened at the East Bay Meditation Center, and it's such a wonderful space. And I know, you know, Alice Walker pops through there often, you know, for the meditations. And, I would meet there with the Sister Sacred Circle with Sister Lola Hanif and the other people that are gathered. That would be the, I think, the third Thursday each month. And I want to let our audience know who didn't catch Sister Lola last week and Jenaba, who was the special guest last Thursday, that the Sacred Circle has actually moved from the ECA Meditation Center, which is so convenient, right there on Broadway. And so I was like, oh, the Dharmathon, wow, that sounds so, like, PC and good and wonderful. And what is it? And it's their second annual. I'm like, ah, sounds great. So it's a 24-hour fundraising and event benefiting the ECA Meditation Center. And I remember when you all were in Emeryville and I don't remember the name of the person who was sort of like the person spearheading the meditation center there. But you have moved around quite a bit, and you've been in your current location for quite a while now. So, you know, you have, like, claimed that corner, which is really great.
Yes.
Yeah, and you're the development assistant for the East Bay Meditation Center, so which means that you raise money. That's nice.
Yeah.
So tell us about the East Bay Meditation Center and about the Dharmathon and when it's happening and how people can plug in.
Yeah. Well, the East Bay Meditation Center moved into that space that you know of now in Oakland in 2006.
Oh, you've been there
so
a lot. 6 years. Nice.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lovely space. We're really committed. It's a meditation center that's deeply committed to diversity and inclusiveness and bringing the teachings of Buddhism to folks who wouldn't otherwise have access. And as a result of this commitment, we have just had this Sangha that has been growing and growing. They're so dedicated and wonderful practitioners, inspiring for all of us that are a part of the organization. And we really think of the organization as theirs as well. You know, it's not an us-them. We're building this together. So it's really an amazing community to be a part of, and I'm so happy to be able to support them in the role of development assistant. That's what I do there.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that capacity, one of the things I'm doing is helping out planning the Dharmathon, which, as you said, it's a 24-hour event. It's the second annual, and last year's was such a tremendous success that we wanted to do this every year. So we're really excited about it. We have speakers from all over the Bay Area that are coming. We have entertainers from all over the Bay Area that are coming. It's 24 hours, not just of Dharma talks and meditation, but we're going to have drumming. We'll have chanting, dance. There'll be a belly dancing class even, yoga, spoken words, Tai Chi. I mean, I could go on and on. Mm-hmm. And all offered by our Sangha members to the participants to support them in their 24 hours of being there and being present to support East Bay Meditation Center.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, you know, where the Dharmathon is occurring and how people can support those that are going to be meditating, since it's a fundraiser, or how you know, people who are interested, like, do you have to meditate to come? Can you? How does it work?
Sure. Right. Well, the way it works is, in order to participate, you can either fundraise for East Bay Meditation Center, and you can do that on firstgiving.com/EBMC for East Bay Meditation Center. You can either fundraise, so you set up a fundraising page, firstgiving.com makes it very, very easy to do that, and you start fundraising. Or you can go to firstgiving.com/EBMC and buy a ticket. So those are two ways that you can participate in the Dharmathon. We're also looking for volunteers, so we, you know, people have time to volunteer for setup during the event breakdown. That's another way to get involved. And then a way to support the Dharmathon and the Dharmathoners, we call them the participants, is to donate. So you can visit those fundraising pages that I mentioned that were built and donate there. You can donate to individual fundraisers' efforts, or you can just donate generally to East Bay Meditation Center. And participants have set personal goals. There's a minimum that we request to people to fundraise, but every fundraiser has set their own personal goals that they want to raise for East Bay Meditation Center, and folks can just donate and support them in meeting that goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell us something about, you know, about the East Bay Meditation Center. You mentioned some sort of some words like sangha and dharma. What is that? And and the whole thing, like, why meditate? And I believe the group that comes in after Sacred Circle was the People of Color sitting group. And I remember going out to it's in Marin County, Spirit Rock for the People of Color weekend retreats. And I was so happy when the East Bay Meditation Center opened up. I was like, I could go here a little more, you know, more frequently. And
right.
And I remember some of the conversations because, you know, at Spirit Rock, which is a really wonderful organization, people would talk about, you know, how it was just so wonderful to be with other people of color in this type of environment, you know, meditating together in a way that, you know, not that meditating in, you know, in groups where one might be the minority or of maybe not even having anyone there from your community to identify with. But it was really great, you know, being together. And so long as you could talk about, you know, some of the regular groups. But first, you know, sort of let's tell us a little bit about just the practice itself.
Yeah, sure. Well, just to start with the practice, yeah, I throw around these terms, Dharma, Sangha, and I take for granted that, you know, they're new to a lot of people. People haven't heard some of these terms. And so when I say Dharma, really what I'm referring to are wisdom teachings. The East Bay Meditation Center is they really offer a lot of wisdom teachings, mindfulness practices from Buddhist and other spiritual traditions. So that's what I talk about. That's what I'm talking about when I say Dharma. And Sangha simply means community. So our spiritual community that joins us at East Meditation Center, that practices, you know, around the world, that provides support to all of us on this planet. You know, we can define Sangha as just the people that are at East Bay Meditation Center, or Sangha as really our global community. So I use that term very interchangeably. But in the short description of that is simply spiritual community. Mm-hmm. And so the East Bay Meditation Center is really committed to sharing that with folks to help everyone who's seeking to end suffering and cultivate happiness, which is all of us, but to support them in having practices to do that, both for themselves and for their communities. So that's really what the East Bay Meditation Center strives to do. And it was founded in a celebration of diversity, so they really try to offer their programs to the absolute widest possible audience. And they do this in a couple of primary ways. One is to have a lot of programs that are specifically for people of color or lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer questioning, intersex, same gender loving communities, to provide a safe space for individuals who confront the effects of oppression, racism, homophobia, heterosexism in their daily lives. And so they may choose to initially avoid mixed programs because they're looking for that safe space. So we strive to create that for them. And then the other primary way we do this is by offering all of our programs for no registration fee or cost to the participant, with the exception of fundraising programs. Instead, what we do is we invite all participants to make voluntary gifts at the end of each event. And to do this at the level of their ability, both for the teacher and for the center itself. And so this allows us to offer our programs to all individuals, regardless of their economic means. And this is such a powerful practice. This is not something Youth Bay Meditation Center came up with. This is really known as the practice of dana, another Sanskrit word. So these words that I'm using sometimes are Sanskrit words. And dana is the practice of generosity, and it's a Buddhist teaching. And it's really about giving joyfully, giving what you can and doing it with a sense of joy and happiness. And we can't give joyfully if we're you know, stretching and straining our pocketbooks to the point that we can't sustain ourselves, you know, personally or support our families. So really it's about giving at a level that you can give and that is joyful for you, you know, giving from the heart.
Nice, nice. Yeah, and what brings you to this practice?
Wow. Yeah, well, my own personal story, In 2001, I experienced just a series of losses that were really profound for me, all in the space of just a few weeks, really. I lost a very close family member. I lost my job, and I also lost a relationship that was really important to me, really precious. And I just, my world was shaken, you know. I really had the rug pulled out from under me. And I just thought, what is this whole thing of life about? If these things that I, you know, just took for granted and assumed would be there forever, you know, nothing lasts. You know, it just really hit me so profoundly. And so I began my search. And I came to meditation. I came to yoga. And these things really carried me through some of the most challenging months and years of my life, and at one point I finally was getting to this place of really struggling being the only person of color in a lot of the meditation sits I went to, mm-hmm. and I was just telling myself, wow, if I could find a place where I could feel a little bit more included and belonging and somewhere a little bit safer, maybe I could start asking questions, because I was getting to that point where I had questions. I've been reading books, practicing on my own, and all the books said, yes, you need to meditate, but you need community. And I'm so independent. I thought, oh, I can do this by myself. But I got to the point where I read enough books and started realizing I do need community. I need community around me. I need support. I need teachers. I have questions. And I was blessed to come across the East Bay Meditation Center before their doors even officially opened. I saw the space on the corner of 22nd Street and Broadway in Oakland, and I said, what is this? Downtown Oakland, what is this with Tibetan prayer flags hanging on the window? And I walked in, and I was overwhelmed with gratitude for the space and for the people who thought to create it in this community, and so accessible to BART, accessible for people with limited mobility issues, was wheelchair accessible, mm-hmm. accessible to people with multiple chemical sensitivities. You know, they work really hard to keep it scent-free and educate folks about multiple chemical sensitivities so that people who have come to the center know that coming scent-free is what we really need to protect, you know, our brothers and sisters that have multiple chemical sensitivities. So I was floored and so grateful to find this space, and I found my spiritual home when I found East Bay Meditation Center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was just looking at the website, you know, there have been some really wonderful, like the retreat at Tassajara Hot Springs that just ended on the, oh, no, actually it's going on right now. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's through tomorrow. But you know, because you're talking to us. Oh, darn. But it sounds really cool. Zen and Vipassana. I love Vipassana Buddhism. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, so the Buddha's practices and teachings, and because there are a lot of people that, you know, they chant and, you know, they meditate. Could you talk about sort of a little bit about that and why, you know, you talked about how personally that was so grounding and healing for you. So wonder if you could talk about that.
Sure, I would love to. Well, my own practices are mostly rooted in Vipassana and in yoga. So those are my personal practices.
Okay.
And the overlap is really, truly astonishing. I mean, there's so many parallels, because I think in the end, these practices are really about connecting to ourselves and connecting to the divine, which, you know, all the practices recognize are the same. You know, we're all divine, all of us. And, I mean, this is, oh, gosh, I feel like you could ask 100 meditators or 100 spiritual practitioners and you're going to get 100 different answers. So, I want to be clear, this is just my own personal experience. I definitely am not an expert by any means. But what drawed me to these practices really is, and they all bring out that same quality of connection for me, but what draws me is connecting to that divine, to that place in myself that is so much greater than just me, that really is, that is everything. And different people have different paths that they use to get there, and I think that that's why there is chanting, that's why there is meditation, that's why there is yoga, that's why there is spiritual study, you know, books, that's why there are so many different paths, different ways to get there. There, and I use there loosely, because really there is no there.
That's the point, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. I guess
exactly.
Who was it that said there is no there? So that's
right.
Good.
Exactly. So just connecting with that everythingness, that everywhere, every time, that place that we can't get to by thinking, but by practicing ways to remove ourselves from our minds and get to that place of no there. No there, no thing, no one, but everything, everywhere, and everyone. So, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a way to, it was one of the best ways to alleviate stress, right?
It is. And it's funny because, you know, Buddhists have been meditating for years, thousands of years, and Western science is finally catching up and finally saying, oh, you know, this meditation thing, it's good for you.
Yeah, and a lot of times people,
yeah,
a lot of times people think that they can't meditate or they can't practice yoga because they might have another spiritual tradition, and doing the practice would be sort of taking on another spiritual or religion. But then I've heard that one doesn't, you know, one can be of another faith tradition and still, you know, practice, you know, these particular, meditate, you know, practice yoga and things like that. What are your views on that?
Yeah, my perspective is certainly that this can supplement anyone's already spiritual, religious, personal practices.
Uh-huh.
We all do these things in our own ways. All spiritual traditions have a form of meditation. We may call it prayer.
Mm-hmm.
We may have another word for it. But really, they're all just practices that help us connect to that spiritual place, that spiritual home that we're looking for. So these are just practices, you know, you can approach them different ways. Certainly you can make make it your religion, or you can just take what works for you and use it to supplement your own religion, use it to connect more deeply to your own practice. So I encourage folks to try it. Try it and see what you think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You have your own experience, because that's the thing. These are so experiential. All these practices are so experiential. They're about your own personal experience. So I invite people to come, try, ask questions,
mm-hmm.
you know, explore and see how you experience it in your own practice, your own religion, your own spirituality.
Yeah, well, super. So why don't you give us the information again, you know, the details about the Dharmathon. It's going to be 24 hours, the 24th through the 25th. Give us the location and tell the people again about how they can be involved. You mentioned that they could be a supporter and they could actually go online and purchase something.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gladly. It's going to be starting from 9 a.m. Saturday, August 25th, and going to 9 a.m. Sunday, August 26th. So it's a 24-hour event. People don't have to participate for all 24 hours if they want to come. They can participate for 6, 12, or 24. And in order to participate, you do need to fundraise or buy a ticket. This is one of those events that are one of the very rare events that Eastern Meditation Center does have, that we do have a some sort of financial requirement. But if you don't have the money, you can fundraise and collect it in small amounts if you need to from friends and family. And to do that, you can go to firstgiving.com/EBMC, find out all the information about the event. You can participate. You can donate there. You can buy a ticket there if you'd like. You can start fundraising there. So it's all there in one place for you. And, yeah, and, you know, actually, if I could also tack on one more thing, too, about meditation and yoga, what I often hear people say about it and why they can't do it. Do we have a minute for that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. Which is people say, you know, I can't do meditation because I can't quiet my mind, or I can't do yoga because I'm not flexible. And I just want to encourage people to understand that it's not that you need to be able to quiet the mind. It's not that you need to be able to wrap your legs behind your head. This is really about, you know, your own spiritual connection, and these practices help get us there. It's a journey. Very few of us can quiet our minds for more than a few seconds. You know, very few of us. It's a challenge for me. I can say that at least. And, you know, I can't do the splits or wrap my legs around my head either. It's a practice, and it's not about that. It's really about connecting to that greater thing, whatever name you want to give it. I hesitate to give it a name because we all have such different names for it. But, you know, connecting to everything.
Right.
So I invite people to come on down to the Dharmathon and explore a lot of different ways that maybe they can do that.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I certainly encourage everyone to visit the website eastbaymeditation.org, and there you can see the regular groups. The one that I'm thinking about maybe joining is the Friday sunrise sitting. That looks nice, 6:10 to 7.
Yeah.
And is that outdoors or indoors?
That's indoors. So many fabulous regular groups. The sunrise sitting, we have a new sangha for Spanish speakers. It's just started up, La Casa del Corazón, which is the home of the heart. We have a people of color sitting group, what we call the Alphabet Sangha sitting group. So many regular groups. I invite folks to check out eastbaymeditation.org also, and yeah, check that out. And we'd love to see you at the sunrise sitting. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah, and don't forget the East Bay Meditation Center's second annual 24-hour Dharmathon, which is this weekend. So join the community. It sounds like it's going to really be wonderful. 9 a.m. Saturday, August 25th through 9 a.m. Sunday, August 26th. Wow, natural high that's going to be for folks.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then on Sunday, September 2nd, from 10 to 5, there's going to be a Healing the Sacred Feminine, another day long. Well, that other one was, the Dharmathon is 24 hours. This is a day long. And then My Home is Here, Refugees and Immigrants of Color, and that's Saturday, September 8th, from 9:30 to 5, and that's another day-long meditation. So, and some people are probably on that great retreat that's concluding on the 23rd, just in time for the Dharmathon.
That's right. Yeah. Keep it up. Keep it up.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Kamala, and I definitely hope that we have you on again. You know, be a regular.
I would love that.
Yeah, we'll have you come on, you know, just like, oh, the Dharmathon, y'all missed it, but blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, you don't want to miss this. And, yeah, maybe we can have some, you know, some other folks from the East Bay Meditation community, you know, to come on and do some testimonies.
Yes, I would love that. I would love that. It's been an honor and a pleasure to be on your show this morning, Wanda. Thank you so much.
Sure, you take good care. And I hope you all raise lots and lots of money.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Okay, you take good care. All right, peace and blessings. Good morning, Anita. How are you?
Good morning. Great.
Great. We're going to have you on Friday as well. So we're going to have you on and talk about the men in me. Wow, it's going to be so cool. Yeah, no, we're going to have you. No, we're going to have
Friday.
You on now, but then I'm going to also, we're going to have you come back on again since I'm cutting your time short. Yeah, but I definitely want people to know that you are in town and you have a new play. And yeah, so why don't you tell us about your new play. People probably know you from having you on the air to talk about Mama Jugs, which was a really wonderful piece you did, sort of, you know, honoring three generations, the voice of three generations of Black women in your family as they struggled with bra stuffing, breastfeeding, and the last stages of breast cancer. All in the context of the social and economic adversity of the Oakland Projects. And you write that you wrote this as a promise to your mother, who died of breast cancer before she was 50 years old. She was a young woman. And your play, Mama Jugs, which is, you know, sort of, I don't know, at least United States renowned, I'm sure. Maybe world renowned, I'm not certain yet. But you can let us know. The play seeks to challenge the cultural taboos and stereotypes surrounding women and their breasts, you know, breast health and body image. And so this new piece, The Men in Me, that sounds really interesting because you're a woman. So tell us about this new piece that you're going to be presenting, two plays in one, Mama Jugs and The Men in Me, this Friday, August 24th at 8 o'clock at the Fellowship of Humanity Hall in Oakland, which is right across from where Sears used to be, 390 27th Street in Oakland.
Yes, this show is really exciting. I just came from Hollywood doing it, and it's basically eight men from my family.
Oh, that's a lot of men.
Included. He didn't really want to be in it, but, you know. I'm in there a little bit with the first love note he sent to me via tape, because we would DJ tapes to each other. And I was like, I have to write the poem that you talk about, the poem that you proposed to me with. And he was like, oh, gosh, no, I don't want you doing that. So I snuck him in there just a tinge. Yeah, it's my six-year-old, my son who was six-year-old at the time, my stepfather who used to be an ex-pimp. So he's in there, my dad who's a truck driver, my two brothers, and a good friend of mine. So there's a lot of different guys, and I try to deal with all the issues they've ever had or things they go through to share that with other people so they can better understand the male condition. Because it's not just about Black men. Cause in our neighborhood in East Oakland and Funktown, it was a little bit of everybody in there.
Hey, where's Funktown? Where is that located?
13th Avenue, East 17th.
Okay.
Down to 5th Avenue, but we were part of it. I guess some of the 5th Avenue folks came up to 13th Ave.
Yeah, so that's over by Laney College, huh?
It's further from Laney College. Actually, it's near Foothill and 14th and Foothill.
Okay.
So it's
so is that close, like going toward Highland?
Exactly. It's down
okay.
Highland. If you took that one street from Highland Hospital and went all the way down, you'd bump into Funktown. It's
okay.
Not as funky as it used to be, but, you know.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, you write that The Men in Me, it explores the trials and triumphs of Black folk, and, oh, no, that's Mama Jugs. No, No, both of them do that. The Mama Jugs and the Men in Me are complimentary works that explore the trials and triumphs of Black folk. And the Men in Me, as you mentioned, all the men that you're going to be telling the stories of, are stories of Black males, young and old, straight and gay, liberated and incarcerated, who hunger to grow beyond bleak circumstances and dismal statistics. Their chosen roles, whether dead, ending, or circling back, or opening up, helped to shape you, you know, Anita Chantel Woodley, into the woman you are today. And, you know, a lot of times people don't hear about how, you know, we hear a lot about how boys need men in their lives to be men. However, the voices that say and the scholarship that supports how girls need men in their lives to be women, that's like, that's a lesser, you know, that the particular voice or that particular type of championing for girls to have men in their lives, not boyfriends, you know, but
yes.
Fathers and uncles.
And that they have to call daddy. That's a whole other situation.
Yeah.
And it's different because, you know, when you listen to music and things now, that's what you hear. And part of having my stepfather in the house that used to be a pimp way back in the day was great because when a girl was talking to me about, I want you to come to this party with me and my daddy's going to be mad if you don't come. And I'm like, well, why is your father so concerned about me coming to a party? I have no idea that's code for a pimp.
Oh.
Now, if I didn't have this guy in my house that knew about this, there's just certain things men know about that we don't. I mean, women are fabulous, we're great, but there are certain things we don't know. Mm-hmm. And those males are very vital in our existence. We need them. We really need them and should want them around, even in their different capacities. I mean, we deal with them when we can, but we have to have them around. And so for me, being able to portray them and not try to say, I'm a man, you know, but to tell their story and to just get into their essence is an honor to do that because now people are like, wow, this is something. Like, I didn't know men could be that valuable. Mm-hmm. They'll look at some guys and say, oh, he's just a thug. But even him, he can add something to your life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Everybody has something. Just don't look at their circumstance. Look at beyond that. And they're human. They're fully human. That's the other thing I want to get across with the play. And it's something about a woman portraying a man, which you don't see very often at all. That makes people pause and really listen to what they're saying.
Mhm. Mhm. Right. Yeah. I was just thinking about another person from Oakland who has had a long running show at the Marsh in San Francisco, and and I'm drawing a blank on his name. That's why I'm trying to look it up really quickly. But he has he grew up on 14th. And he had it's Don. Don is his first name.
Mm-hmm.
And he he writes about, you know, sort of his father being Don Reed. He writes about East 14th and he grew up with his mother and his stepfather, but then he as an adolescent he wanted to live with his father, and his father, you know, was a pimp. And
yeah.
And so he, you know, it's a one man show and it's just really, really provocative, and he tells his story. And his father encouraged him to go to school, and he did really well, and everything else, all this other stuff was happening around him, but, you know, he didn't take those particular roads. He went to school. He was a part of the forensics program at one of the Oakland high schools, and, you know, now, you know, he's, you know, on a late evening show, I'm not certain which one, and, he has this play, and he's making movies, and, you know, just doing really great things. And so you tell these stories of you know, women and men, you know, in Oakland. And there aren't that many, you know, positive stories coming out of Oakland, even today. I was like, wow, that is so crazy. So tell us how you do that, Mama Jugs, you know, you have all of these voices of three generations of Black women, and then this particular new show, The Men in Me, which is featuring, you know, live bass guitar and original social justice poetry. You're portraying these men. So do you take on their characters, or are you yourself talking about these relationships, or are you actually these men?
I become the men, and then I am the main, the through line, the main narrator throughout the show. But I take on them. I have, like, their favorite, some of their favorite items, and I take on who they are and their voices and everything. So, yeah, it's a bit of work, but it's worth it. And I also deal with the death rate of the black men and the different guys who are killed around the country by law enforcement and also by just other people on the street, and deal with that in interpretive dance as well. And then I play the bass in the play as well. And I picked that up a few months ago, but apparently I'm a natural bass player because I actually play some Sly and the Family Stone, some Whispers, and everything else.
Wow.
Heard those are some of the hardest bass lines, and I was like, are you serious? Because I'm just kind of playing it over here. Okay. So I guess I'm probably channeling Jimi Hendrix or somebody. I have no idea. But it's a great experience to have and to be able to do that and to be able to capture their rhythm and things like that without putting on fat suits or wigs and all this other stuff, because I put on plain clothes so you don't see how shapely I am, but at the same time, you can clearly tell I'm a woman. So I do not try to become a man. That's not the point of it. A lot of men, when they play us, they try to become women.
Right.
And you can't really tell. You think either that's a woman that needs a lot of makeup or either it's a man. But I don't do that. I don't feel you have to go into all of that stuff. I grew up with my great-grandmother, and she would tell me, if you're going to do something, do it, and don't put nothing on. Mm. If you're 100, show me you're 100, don't put no wig on. Go. So I come from that school of theater, which is home-based theater. Well, you didn't have all that stuff, which is great for me because you get to actually show people that this is real. This isn't something I'm making up. And when you get into all the other theatrics, for me, sometimes it takes away from the authenticity of the piece because people know, okay, that's a woman that's dressed up like a man.
Mm-hmm.
And it detracts from the work because they're focused on how you're dressing up. And I want people to really pay attention to what's happening and getting involved in that. And so far, so good. It's working and people are enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you actually portray your son, you said, right?
Yes, when he was 6 years old and we visited Oakland.
So how old is he now?
He's nine and a half.
So how does he feel about you portraying him? Does he say, oh, you got it, Mommy, that's me?
He loves it. He asked if he could read the script, and I gave it to him, and he was giggling in the back seat, and he said, exactly what I would say. I said, I know, because I took some of the parts of his part from his actual schoolwork. He's pretty precocious and writes really advanced sentences and stories. So I took some of the words, and they happened to fit right in my script. So basically you see him doing what he usually does. He has a calculus book with him or a writing book everywhere we go, and he'll ask you these profound questions, and then he's writing in between doing his sentences.
Wow.
And when I was in L.A., people said, you know, I just loved your son, the characterization of your son, because that's exactly what just a little Brainiac kid would be doing, just sitting there observing, but at the same time doing what kids do.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Huh. So could you maybe give us a little bit of your son or some other character?
Sure. So this would be my son, Xavier. Like I said, he's 6 years old, and we were visiting, the setup is we were visiting our house and sitting on the porch, and then he started asking me questions about some. So here's how it goes. Let's see, vocabulary exercises. Write a sentence using the words below. Object, let's see. Object, I do not object when my parents have great ideas. Okay, why is that man standing there on the corner? He was in the same spot yesterday, and he was there last night, and now he's in the same place again today. Standing there in the exact same spot. There's not a stop sign there that says pause his stride, and there's not a stoplight there indicating that he shouldn't walk. Hasten. In the morning, I get ready for school. I have to hasten my pace. Yes. What did you say, Mama? Seriously? Oh, Nona, you think he is there selling drugs? Well, isn't he aware that a judge will take away his freedom for doing that? Oh, befuddled. My friend says I've never befuddled him before, but I have. And conceal, when I have to take a shower, I try to conceal myself. Mama, remember when you told me when you were a child you'd pick flowers and sell them to buy a chicken and 10-pound bag of potatoes and onions and seasoning salt so your family could eat? Well, you didn't have to sell drugs. Really? It's a belief that there's a white man that's keeping him on the corner to sell drugs. Mama, I am not talking back, but I have not seen one white person in this neighborhood since we've been here. Okay. So that's just a bit of Xavier.
Oh, wow. That's great. That's really great.
Yeah, he was just puzzled. And for the first time, you know, I've accepted it, like, okay, this is what the guys do in the neighborhood. They sell drugs, they get up early, the guys drink. And my son was just like, hold up. Every excuse I gave him, he debunked.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, where's that white guy at? I haven't seen one white guy. I mean, where's the logic in this? Because he'd like to be a scientist, so he's always studying things and looking at people.
Okay.
And it wasn't logical to him.
Yeah.
And so I just loved it. I was like, wow. And then years later when I start writing the play, I thought about, you got to have that in there because here's a kid that's not taking all those excuses.
Mm-hmm.
He just doesn't have them right now. And I'm sure as he grows up, he'll come up with little excuses of his own for things. But it was just a proud moment for him not to think it's normal for a black male to stand on a corner.
Yeah, that's awesome. So
yeah,
are you raising Xavier here?
You know, we're in North Carolina. That's where I work for NPR. I'm on a public radio on a show called The Story with Dick Gordon. So we moved out there 6 years ago for me to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when we talked, you said that, and I was like, oh, so you're still there. Okay, so this is a real treat for you to be coming to the Bay Area, to California, Southern California first last week and now Northern California. Because you don't live here anymore. Oh, that's nice. So when you come to town, it's like a family reunion, huh?
It is, and I have to raise money and stuff because it is not cheap to fly across the country because I'm flying from one coast to another. And so when I come here, people usually do come out and show support because they know, okay, she might not be back for a year or two again to do another show. And that's why I'm doing Mama Jugs and The Men and Me.
Right.
So that people, because I can't come here and just do my new show, because they all want to see Mama Jugs. They all want to see Grandma and everybody else. So I done created something here, honey. I said, oh, God, what am I going to do? The more shows I do, I'm going to be up on the stage for 10 hours, because they're like, we want to see all the shows.
How many shows are there?
Well, so far there's two, but I have 12 in queue.
Oh, wow.
Next
so
one will be
so
about me
like
going to Africa to meet my tribe. I did that two
Ooh.
Years ago. I went in the bush, not a safari. I'm talking about
Ooh.
In the bush where they live like Shaka Zulu did.
Where are your people from?
I'm from Cameroon and the village called Inditam, mm-hmm. and I'm from the Tikar tribe. And I danced with the pygmies, and they named me, I'm not from the pygmy tribe, I'm from the Tikar tribe, but the pygmies are our neighbors.
Okay.
They named me Princess Becca, and way in the bush, 10-hour drive on a single lane road, dodging logging trucks and everything. It was wild, but I have it on video, getting my name, lots of audio, so it'll be a multimedia experience.
Nice.
So I have plenty of plays to write. Oh my gosh, I just need more time.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So, tell us about your day job and how that connects with your.
Well, on my day job, I call around the country and interview people about first person narratives. So, if the minimum wage goes up 25 cents, I call and find someone who's that 25 cents will make a big difference for their lives. And coming up, I think in the last week of August when I go back to work, or either beginning of September, I interviewed a lady who helped fight voter registration restrictions. And so now here she is, 75 years into organizing, and it's coming back around again where people are putting things in place to stop folks from voting. So we're going to talk to her about how she organized people and the strategies they're using this year in order to have people's votes still count that don't have an actual birth certificate and all these things, but they've been voting all their lives. So it's a pretty interesting show. You get to tell stories, and it's definitely refined my storytelling abilities because I know how to get to a point. I know when something's not working, and I keep it moving, which is great when you're doing live theater.
Right. Wow, that's really cool. And, see, we're going to actually have to close this wonderful conversation in a few minutes because I got to get to work. But we'll have you on again on Friday. So, audience, stay tuned. So tell us how you got into, you know, these first-person narratives on stage, you know, telling your family stories.
Well, I went to a party, and they asked, it was like a artist renaissance party in Pittsboro, North Carolina, and they asked you to bring something in, and I was like, I don't really have anything, but I do have this Titty Milk Titty Jug song my grandma wrote for me. And I went to the party and sang that song, and they were just falling on the floor, and one guy said, you should turn that into a play. And I was like, what, I don't act, you know, I'm a journalist, I report the facts, I don't make them up kind of thing. And then the next morning I woke up, I wrote the whole play in 4 hours. Yes,
wow.
And then I practiced for 7 months because I never memorized something longer than a poem, not 35 pages of material. And then it got too big for their home, so I had to rent a theater if I wanted to do it. And so I ended up renting a theater. 64 people showed up, and I had to learn that, you know, there was an all-white audience with a couple of black folks sprinkled in there, but they don't make a lot of noise during the show. It's like a theater culture where you're quiet, and then when the lights go down, you clap a lot, and then you're quiet. So for the first 5 minutes, I thought I was probably doing a horrible job because nobody was responding to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the lights went down, and then quiet. And then at the end, they gave me a 1.5-minute standing ovation because I put it into the audio program. That's how I knew how long it was. And I was just in shock. And then I had to come to Oakland next and
right.
do it. And I was very nervous because my mom had been dead probably about 8 years, but my great-grandma that lived to be 100 had died about a year before that. So I knew if I didn't do it right, my family in Oakland don't play, honey. They will let you know in no uncertain terms.
Mm-hmm.
And when they loved it and my aunties and brothers and stuff were crying, I said, I got it. I must be doing something right. And my auntie said, that wasn't you. That was your mama that came down here. You ain't that good. It's been 3 years, and I just kept going, and it's turned into, oh, let me do the men. Oh, let me do this. Oh, let me do that. And I feel that I'll be 100 years old doing Mama Jugs. I might be sitting on a stool.
Mm-hmm.
But I bet people will pay to come see it. They'll say, let's see how the old lady play the 17-year-old now.
Oh, yeah. That would be really cool.
Yes, it would. I think the older I get, the better the show will become.
Nice. Wow. Well, congratulations on the new show, and I'm so happy you're doing both because I haven't seen Mama Jugs. I'm looking forward to seeing Mama Jugs with the men and me. So, how long is the does it take for you to do both plays in one night? Because usually you only get one play in one night.
Yes, that's usually because, in my opinion, the other shows are too long. Anyway. Journalist in me, I'm like, look, honey, we can tell that story better in 60 minutes instead of hour and a half, okay? but what it is the men and me goes about 45 to 50 minutes,
okay.
And then I take a 15-minute break, and people look at the different artwork and merchandise and get whatever they want to get. And then I come back and do Mama Jugs, and that usually takes about 55 to 60 minutes. So you're there the normal amount of time you would be usually for a single-person show, up to 90 minutes or 120 minutes some people have. So you don't even think it's that long, and then you're like, I want to hear more stories. That's what people write on the note card. Can you add some more stories?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, honey, I'm channeling 12 people. Yes, but see, Oakland is very special because even when I go back to North Carolina and do my new piece, I am not doing both shows. I'm only doing the new show.
Okay.
So I did it for Oakland and for L.A., but I'm not doing that in a while. It'll just be, this is the new show, honey. Get the other one on DVD.
Oh, so that's the merchandising people can actually buy the show so they can play it later.
Mama Jug's show that I shot in Los Angeles, that's there. And then I haven't announced this yet, but I will on your show that I actually have an album out, a soundtrack for the men's show.
Oh, congratulations. Wow.
Social Justice Poetry, and I have it for $10, special price for Oakland, so people will be able to get that. It was mixed and mastered by an artist named Hotline in Bahrain, which is in the Middle East. So he helped me out, and my brother-in-law produced 6 tracks on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he produced about the other half of the thing. But it's all my work, and it's work I've had all this time and didn't even notice I had albums. I have enough for 2 albums.
Nice.
Yeah, so people will get to experience that and bump it because it's got a lot of bass in it. I love my bass. So Men and Me and Mama Jugs is only on one night, though. It's on Friday, August 24th at 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at the Humanist Hall, the Fellowship of Humanity Hall.
Right.
At 390 27th Street in Oakland.
Right.
And then the next day, on Saturday, I'm going to be doing Mama Jugs only at Sweet Fingers Jamaican Restaurant.
Okay.
Yes,
I didn't understand that particular part. Oh, okay, so you're doing it twice while you're here. But
yes,
you're only doing
do
the Men and Me with Mama Jugs on the Friday.
Yes. So both of them on Friday, but on Saturday it's only Mama Jugs, and it's a midnight showing.
Oh yeah, I was thinking. I thought you were doing the show. It was going to be overnight. Okay, I understand that.
So it starts. The doors open at 10 p.m. They're going to give away baskets, have cocktails, all that stuff, and have a DJ.
Wow, a nighttime show. Wow, that sounds like a midnight show. Wow. Have you done that before, or is that just special?
I sure haven't. A friend that I went to high school with contacted me when she saw I was coming out here and said, what do you feel about doing a midnight show at a club? And I said, sounds like fun. My mama liked going to Sweet Jimmy's. I was like, yeah, we'll do it. So at the stroke of midnight, we'll start the show.
That sounds like a fun experience. And then it's late enough to where people who are doing other things can come. It's like a jam session kind of time.
Exactly. So the people that want to see both shows are coming on Friday, and the ones that are like, oh, I just want to see Mama Jugs, they're coming on Saturday.
Right. Some people that love it so much on Friday are going to come on Saturday too.
And that always happens here. Every time I do shows, they will do that. They will come to the next show. Every time I do. Every time. I'll see the same people like, what are you? Girl, it was so good, I had to come again. Especially because of the improv and stuff. They really enjoy it. But if people want more information, because that was just like, oh, that's a lot of information, they can go to mamajuggs.com, and so that's mamajuggs.com, and click on the show calendar, and it has all the information there. They can even order tickets online.
Okay, super. Wow, well, thank you so much for joining us, Anita, and congratulations on the new show, and gosh, how many do you have waiting in the wings?
12. Mm-hmm. And the more I live, I'll probably keep adding to that list.
Wow, that's good to always have material, you know, and be that open and receptive to create a process.
Yeah, exactly. You have to always be growing and doing something. And you know, you were the first show that interviewed me when I did Mama Jugs.
Oh, seriously?
For my first interview 3 years ago.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? It's like now you're my first interview 3 years later when I do my new show. So I think I've started something. Every time I do a new show, I have to come on your show first.
Oh, well, it's my honor. I'm so happy. I love to get, the scoop, as they say.
I'll give it to you.
Thank you so much. And next time, maybe for Friday, maybe you could send me an MP3, and we could play a little bit of you, maybe play a song or play something, on the air to sort of give folks the ambience of the performance itself.
Wonderful. Yeah, we can definitely do that. I'll send you those.
Okay, super. Excellent. Well, I've got a dash, so you have a great morning, and thank you so much for being on the show. Looking forward to Friday.
Okay, thank you, and see you soon.
All right, peace and blessings. Bye-bye. So we're going to close the show with a piece from Maclete Hadaro from A Day Like Today, and it's called Wake Up, If You're Not Already Awake. No, Walk Up, sorry.
Walk up straight through the room, straight through the hole in the ceiling. Take your place in the sky. Oh, look around at the clouds that hold you, that hold. Tornado from the air. Oh, it feels just like you dreamed, just like you dreamed. Oh, your shoulders are clear. They have given up the weights and the knots. Waves and the nuts, the waves and the nuts. No more gravity around you, no more gravity, no more gravity.
On a day like this, oh well.